We'll go into the open public input, and I think everybody's familiar with the operation there. 3 minutes, the buzzer will go off, and or else I will make a visual sign, which is not decapitation, that's just stop. You can finish your thoughts, but wind it up then. I will call you up at the first two, and then the second two want to come together. So the first two, Mr. Kavanaugh and Larry Breitspecker, please. So, Mr. Kavanaugh, you're first. I just, you were listed as number one, so.
My name is Rob Kavanaugh. I'm here today to tell you about the conflict resolution we had with your staff. Thanks to Joe Storr, set up a conflict resolution opportunity for the public. It was a really enlightening meeting. We didn't resolve many conflicts, but it was a good exchange of information. So it was productive and worthwhile, in my opinion, and I hope we can do this again sometime. I'd like to just remind you briefly of the mission and the procedures and the policy dealing with grazing with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. There's a procedure to accomplish commission policy with respect to grazing, and that is initiated by the wildlife area manager. And she or he does that by justifying the use of cattle. There's a grazing plan connected with all permits, and it describes the benefits to fish, benefits to wildlife, and the benefits to ecological integrity. Then there's WAC 232-12-181, and bow-legged 2 says the highest benefits to fish and wildlife. And I'm using the term benefit, and I hope you pick up on that. And then we go again to land acquisition. We use best science. We maintain ecological integrity. And the plan must include fish and wildlife benefits. House Bill 1309, which I helped write, goals describe the benefits to fish and wildlife habitat and the effects on 1309 expected benefits. Well, where I'm going with this is, if you read the memorandum for record that I prepared, your staff agreed that grazing does not benefit fish. That's right. We knew it, and they now know it, and they agreed with that. It does not benefit wildlife in any way, shape, or form. We knew it, and now they know it. And it does not benefit ecological integrity. So when you're considering these permits as they come before you, ask the question, how does this benefit fish, wildlife, or ecological integrity? And if it doesn't, you shouldn't be doing it. Because if it's not benefiting, it's harming. It's not neutral. When you take away the natural forage resources and give it to the cattle, it's taking away something from wildlife. And just remember that. We now have a fact. And it was derived from the pilot grazing project done by an independent group, Washington State University, Dr. Linda Hardesty. So I hope you'll consider that in your decision-making dealing with livestock grazing. And I want to thank Joe Storr for setting that meeting up for us, and it served a good purpose. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kavanaugh. Any questions? Yes.
If this is true, I think we need to have more information, because this is not my understanding of what the science has shown in relation to grazing, that a moderate or light level of grazing, from what I understand, is beneficial. So I would like to just ask for a briefing.
You want me to give you a briefing?
No. No, I would like a briefing from our staff.
I had the scientists from Washington State University willing to come to this meeting, and your staff excluded them. They could have answered your question right then and there. Dr. Don Nelson, animal nutrition scientist. So it's out there.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's a good question. Any further? Okay. Larry?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
I probably won't use my whole 3 minutes, but anyway, I'm from Westport. I'm a commercial crab fisherman there. I've been fishing probably for 33 years or so. I bought my first boat in 1982, and I've had three of them since. But anyway, we've got such a messed up since the Rafiti decision down there that some of us are having a hard time making it with the way Fish and Game has our season set up and our two-month late start at the beginning of the season. When we should be able to fish all the way up to the South Jetty, there's no reason why we can't start the same time the Columbia River and all them guys start, because that SMA isn't anywhere near from the South Jetty to the river. And another thing is the summertime limits that they're putting on us at the end of the season. I mean, we've already lost the beginning of our season, so now we get to the end of our season. The limits that they are allowing us to have and keep and catch don't pay for our fuel, or let alone any upkeep or crew members. So we're not happy with that. And then the SMA from Capellas Rock to DI that is close to us and has been now for like 12 or 14 years is where a lot of us used to fish, and myself and Jeff here, for like over 20 years we fished there, and then all of a sudden one day we're told we can't fish where we've been fishing for the last 20 years. And that was after I took Fish and Game out to check crab for like 10 years, over 110 trips in that 10-year period, all from where they closed us out of. So that kind of was upsetting to me that that's where I take up testing for 10 years and then I'm excluded from it. And another thing is, since we've lost the beginning of our season for the first 2 months, we still pay the same amount for our licenses as everybody else does, the Columbia River and everybody else that gets to start December 1st. We don't get to start until sometime in February 15th, sometimes February 1st. So we're paying the same price for our licenses as they are with the two-month more season longer than we have. And then another thing is enforcement. It's really hard for us to get good crew with the way we've been shrunk down with what we can do. It's hard to keep good crew, and the enforcement I've noticed has been feeding off of that because they're counting on us having crab and stuff on the boat that we're not supposed to due to the lack of experience, I guess, with your deckhands, not knowing what, you know, even though we tell them what to keep, what not to keep, we still have a trouble with them. And so there's been a lot of tickets written lately. So, and one more thing is that there's, if you guys, when you're dealing with our association, our crab association, there's only like 20 members in that association, and most of them are there only for one reason, and that's to make sure what they've got molded right now stays the way it is right now, because a lot of them fish down in California, and they have set their fisheries up to where they count on that two-month late start that we have now in Washington. So they come from Oregon and California and jump right on us when we start. We don't find that fair. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Larry. Any questions? Thank you. And then calling up Colleen Thompson and Dick Wallace, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Colleen Thompson, and I'm the Managing Director of the Regional Fisheries Coalition. The coalition represents all 14 regional fishery enhancement groups statewide, and we're here speaking in support of the investments in the Wild Future Initiative for the RFEG program. One of the reasons we have so many anglers on our boards and our staff and those who come out to volunteer on the projects is they recognize how critical habitat is to vibrant salmon populations and fishing opportunity now into the future. RFEGs implement about 150 habitat projects every year with the help of thousands of citizen volunteers. Rachel Vasek from the Nooksack Salmon Enhancement Association did an excellent job at your last meeting describing our programs and projects statewide and our accomplishments. As you know, the program has a 25-year history as nonprofits working at the community level to engage citizens who may not otherwise want to engage with governmental entities in salmon habitat restoration. The $1.4 million in the Wild Future Initiative is critical to the continued success of the program. State funding to RFEGs took a dramatic hit this year, with a decrease by 52%. This is largely due to the decrease in the excess carcass and roe contract, which is half of the funding received at the state level. The other half is through a portion of recreational fishing licenses and commercial fishing licenses, and that portion hasn't increased in the 25 years of the program. As the purchasing power of that program, or the purchasing power of that dollar that hasn't changed in 25 years, salmon projects have also become more complex. Now, many of the projects take multiple years to complete, which will become difficult if we do not have the funding to maintain staff positions. And RFEGs are also expected to be one of the primary sponsors of the projects in the Fish Passage Barrier Removal Board prioritized list. We reached a tipping point this year. Without additional funding, RFEGs will implement fewer projects in the coming years. You have several letters in your packets from our boards across the state detailing the impact of that we'll have without additional funding in the coming years. And I also want to be clear about our own process and getting to the point where we're making this request, and thank DFW staff, many of you, and stakeholders for vetting numerous funding options with us. With that being said, the $1.4 million in the Wild Futures Initiative is critical to this maintaining existing operations of the program. If received, it really puts us back at square one with this money backfilling reductions and maintaining just the existing operations of the program. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dick Wallace. He's a board member at South Puget Sound Salmon Enhancement Group.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Dick Wallace, and I do volunteer on the local Salmon Enhancement Group. I was honored with a long career in public resource management, including being able to serve on the Salmon Recovery Funding Board, the Forest Practices Board, and then finally Governor Gregoire appointed me to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. So in my retirement years, I decided the investment of my time is best at the local level with the on-the-ground work. And so it's highly rewarding to work with the local Salmon Enhancement Groups, the partnerships we form with tribes, local governments, you name it, to do the on-the-ground work. Because the investment in habitat is really where it's at. And as a longtime fisherman, I recognize that, sure, it's a increase in my license number, my license fee, but the investment in habitat is so well worth it. When I look at everything that I and other fisher folks spend, this is the best place to make the investment and actually increase not only fish habitat, but when you do that, you help create more biodiversity, more resilient ecosystems, and you benefit all fish and wildlife, because really our streams are the lifeblood of the ecosystem. So with that, I'd like to thank you. Also support the work of the Wild Future Initiative. Appreciate the collaboration we've had with the department in coming up to this and in working going into the future. It's good stuff. And so I thank you for your time, and I hope you look on it favorably. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any let me personally thank you both for the work you do with the RFEGs. I concur wholeheartedly. They are a strong partner with the department and a proud asset to the state as well. So continue on. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And excuse me. Jamie Glasgow and Jordan Royer, please.
Chair Smith, thanks for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. My name is Jamie Glasgow. I'm Director of Science for Wild Fish Conservancy. I'm here to talk with you about wild stock gene banks in Puget Sound. This is following up on a letter that Wild Fish Conservancy submitted along with four other conservation organizations to the Commission about a week ago, and over 500 similar letters that were sent by the public within the past week. Puget Sound steelhead were listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 2007. In 2008, the state released the Statewide Steelhead Management Plan, which was the department's initial response to the listing. And in that report, they acknowledged that WDFW hatchery impacts on wild steelhead recovery. and committed to establish a network of steelhead of stock gene banks, wild stock gene banks across the state to protect listed fish from wild listed wild fish from hatchery impacts. In 2009, the Commission Policy C3619 reiterated the same. You'll get an update on that policy later this morning. More than 8 years after committing to establish wild stock gene banks, the department has not yet selected a single wild stock gene bank for any of the three major Puget Sound steelhead populations. The department did start a process a year ago last summer by soliciting public input. The public response was overwhelming. Of 959 respondents, 91% strongly supported the entire Skagit watershed as a gene bank. The Skagit watershed in its entirety perfectly meets the department's own criteria for a gene bank. It has the largest wild steelhead run in Puget Sound, most recently 9,000 plus fish, and abundance continues to increase annually absent hatchery steelhead planting. The population in the Skagit is extremely diverse, and multiple subpopulations of winter and summer run steelhead are distributed throughout the watershed. Skagit drains some of the highest lands in the state, ensuring cold water refuge to buffer against climate change, and much of the watershed is federally protected. It's already protected from Chambers Creek hatchery fish for the next 10 years, and the department's steelhead monitoring program in the Skagit is stronger than anywhere else in Puget Sound, providing data for adaptive management. We have less than 3% of the historical abundance of Puget Sound steelhead, and 12 of 20 populations are at high risk of extinction. NMFS's 2011 and 2015 steelhead population status reviews document continued declines in Puget Sound, and the status of our state fish continues to edge towards an endangered listing. The overwhelming majority of public and technical comments that the department received from the public identify the Skagit as North Puget Sound's most logical steelhead gene bank. If the entire Skagit watershed doesn't qualify as a steelhead gene bank, it's hard to imagine what watershed would. I'm asking the Commission to direct the Department to complete the Puget Sound wild steelhead or wild stock gene bank selection process, and in particular to support the Department's designation of the entire Skagit Basin as the cornerstone for gene banks in Puget Sound. Glad to answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Yeah. Commissioner Carpenter.
Mr. Glasgow, I was born on the banks of the Skagit River. Mm-hmm. I know a little bit about it, maybe quite a little bit about it. Your request is thoughtful, and a lot of effort went into it. But the real world is we have three tribes, co-managers, on that river that frankly won't participate in what you're requesting. Makes things a little bit more difficult, and just want to share that with you. I didn't know if you knew that or not.
I'm very aware of that, and that's why I'm here, frankly. I really would like to see the Commission support the department in doing what the department believes is the right thing to do. I know it's not going to be easy. But we're talking about a threatened species in our state fish. And I say threatened, and we all say it, and I think we forget what that means sometimes. That means threatened with extinction. And if extirpating a population of fish from Puget Sound doesn't motivate you, know that what comes next from a regulatory standpoint is an endangered listing, which has significant economic impacts for this region as well. And so I hope that we can all work together to avoid that situation. And when I say we all, I mean the state and the co-managers. It's not easy, but we have a responsibility, and I think we have to do it.
Thank you. Any other comments? Mr. Royer?
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioners, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Jordan Royer. I represent the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association. We represent the marine terminal operators and the shipping lines that call the West Coast. We have offices in Oakland, Seattle, and Long Beach, California. I'm here today to discuss the Aquatic Invasive Species Funding Advisory Council. We're on that council. And my concern is that late afternoon yesterday, we got a notice and a draft piece of legislation from the department to increase or start a ship fee and boarding fees on our vessels for ballast water inspection. Now, the committee had no consensus on whether or not to start up that fee, largely because the federal government and specifically the Coast Guard has really amped up their efforts, starting to approve treatment options for ballast water, all of the other things that we do already, and the federal requirements that are coming online now, that there's some on the committee believe that there was no need to duplicate what the feds were already doing. But my other concern, since I haven't had a chance to read the legislation that you'll be considering later on today, because we got it late yesterday, about 3:30 or so in the afternoon for a public comment in the morning the next day. I've worked for a lot of politicians. I've worked for a lot of government agencies. I've worked outside of government. And when you get something late on a Thursday for a Friday morning, you know there's something up. It's just the alarm bells go off. So I have a lot of concerns with the process. We've been working on these ballast water issues with the agency for the better part of a decade. We feel like we've made some real progress. And in fact, we've been nothing but complimentary about the staff at the agency, because they've worked with us and been very upfront with us, and we've really accomplished a lot. So having this kind of process problem is very concerning for us, and we may have to rethink the way we engage going forward, because frankly we're funding an air emissions inventory for marine emissions throughout Puget Sound right now. We're not opposed to funding to get environmental benefit. We do that all the time, but this kind of last minute, telling us that there's going to be something proposed to you, the commissioners, without any chance for us to discuss it as a group or individually or even to prepare. I had to cancel meetings this morning so I could come down here. So I'm not really happy about it, and I wouldn't do that to them, and I would expect the same courtesy back. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry O'Keefe. I work for the Washington Public Ports Association. I'm working here with Mr. Royer. I'm sorry you've got to deal with a couple of grumpy Irishmen here this morning on this issue.
Could you please do that?
What's that? I did. I signed up outside. As I was thinking about this, of course, there's the surprise that we have to deal with an issue like this. But really what I think is irritating in a bigger sense is a staff proposal that comes to you today without any opportunity as public servants appointed by the governor to talk with people about it in advance. You're presented here with a decision about which ends up being binary. Do we support the staff position, or do we say we don't care about aquatic invasive species? You're not asked to apply intelligence. You're not asked to apply creativity. You're not asked to engage with stakeholders and the public about what the context of this issue is and why people take the positions that they take. From a Ports Association perspective, this is a competitiveness issue for the state of Washington on the global stage. And I can't state it any more clearly than that for you. It's not that we don't care about Puget Sound. We care very much about Puget Sound and aquatic invasive species. But this process is really stinks, and it's not just for us. It's for you as members, where you've got to decide, really? I've got to choose this, or I've got to choose this, and I've got to choose today. Huh. Thank you.
We are going to get a briefing on what the public has said, and you're telling us now that you didn't have an opportunity to weigh in on this, but I want to reassure you that if we give the green light to this set of legislative proposals, it is not the end of the discussion. In fact, staff have been asking us for this budget setting process is going to require more discretion on the part of department staff. So we anticipate there's going to be lots and lots of discussions, and what comes out in the end is not necessarily going to be anything like what we approve.
Well, I understand that. I mean, I do. I understand that. Of course, we have a legislative process. We have the governor's office. This is your opportunity. This is your opportunity to engage and shape the policy of the state of Washington going forward. For us, that's, you know, when we miss a forum like that, we don't like it.
Well, and just very, very briefly, it would have been nice for me to come and speak intelligently about what that legislation is, but I haven't had a chance to study it just because we got it late in the afternoon. When you get something late in the afternoon that's going to be heard on a Friday in August, alarm bells go off. I mean, this isn't my first rodeo. I mean, I know what this signals to me, and it's very concerning, and that's all I wanted to get across today.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, folks, for being here to bring this to everybody's attention. You know, we've had this discussion that's been going on for a long time, and there has not been agreement around, and probably the most contentious part of this, the discussion has been around fees and treatment and all of that. And I mean, we knew that a couple of years ago. I think, I don't know all the background. I just learned this morning about this draft legislation too, from Jerry's. Jerry left me a message. So how that ended up at 3 p.m. in front of you, I don't know. It doesn't seem, if that's the way it was, like the good business, you know, in terms of the no surprises kind of doctrine. But again, I don't know all the steps, and I don't know who's been talking to whom and about the particular piece of legislation. I know we've talked about fees a lot in the past.
Maybe they drafted it just yesterday.
I don't know. I don't know.
I'm being facetious, of course, because they didn't draft it yesterday.
So, as Commissioner Wecker said, I think the intent was to have a placeholder. I think the intent was, because August is the policy legislative budget approval meeting, you know, to have that placeholder in front of the commission. There certainly will be lots of opportunities for additional communication in the future. So, you know, if you guys were surprised, that's not right, and I would apologize for that. But we'll keep working it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. I guess just to go on from what Joe said, this is not a decision being made about any policy. All we're doing is proposing. Go ahead. And
as I understand it, Commissioner, the intent was to have the framework of a proposal in front of you as a starting place for, you know, a placeholder for what will be a lengthy discussion between now, if you choose to allow that to go forward, and the end of the next session. But I don't want to say too much because I don't know.
All right.
Hi, my name is Bonnie Blessing, Olympia, Washington. I was hoping that I was really looking forward to wild futures as some sort of mechanism to encourage habitat enhancement and improvement for the non-game wildlife species in Western Washington. In Western Washington, we have so many species that are in decline, and a lot of these are on private land. We need staff. I've been involved in habitat enhancement for one of these non-game wildlife species, the Oregon spotted frog, a wetland species, using recreationists, hunters. The agricultural industry is interested. The hunting industry is interested. A number of groups are interested in helping out. What folks need from the state is a dedicated staff person that can meet with private landowners, guide them towards some sort of habitat enhancement measures on their land that may include the agricultural, that may be sustainable agricultural endeavors to maintain habitat on their land for a lot of these rare species. We can recover these rare species. We need staff time that can do some surveys, look for those rare species, and improve the habitat management that's done by agricultural or other restoration activities and get these species recovered. There is a road to doing that, and we can include a lot of groups that are very interested in doing that. There needs to be some dedicated staff time to help the volunteer element and others in that. And I hope Wild Futures can maintain some level of funding for to provide private landowners with incentives and monitoring and improvement to their habitat. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ross, you're the last one for this morning.
I'm Ross Barkhurst from NEMA, Washington. Good morning. I'm here to cover the big picture as best I can in 3 minutes about a disaster area in Region 6 known as Willapa Bay. I've chose three indicator species to show you. There are others that would produce similar results. Chum, and that's run reconstruction. Herring, that's spawning mass. And waterfowl, and that's gross numbers. The charts show up in ups and downs, mostly downs. Everyone ends up with a down. They're all the same scale from 2002 through 2015. Okay. These results could show the results of a Fish and Wildlife Department that was functioning as a wildlife monitor rather than a manager. Except in a couple cases I'll try to bring out, they don't monitor either. Okay. We don't monitor spring staging of brant anymore. Nobody counts them. And they're the worst off waterfowl that we have. We don't monitor spawning massive herring since 2007. Policy instructs staff to. They don't. The salmon policy is an okay policy with strong implementation on harvest management. And maybe we'll see a pleasant surprise later today. As far as I can see, no success at HSRG compliance. I've monitored the bay in these things since 2002 full-time. The herring is the best policy and plan I've ever written. I don't think Aldo Leopold or I could improve on it. Okay, don't follow it. Just don't follow it. It says, hey, if you have a possibility of high human impact, go monitor it more closely. Says if something disappears, if they disappear, go look and see when they come back. Waterfowl has suffered from apparently two man-caused disasters, and there's no plan or procedure or process in place to turn that around. This is an overlay of our Spartina eradication effort that I participated in, and this is an overlay of spraying eelgrass. And you should know that that includes spraying eelgrass in the mapped herring spawning beds where we don't look at herring spawning anymore. Okay. When we see the spawning policy compliance, we get worried because we have a pretty fair salmon management policy now. Apparently, there's nothing to keep us from just we don't follow that either. So I would ask that you do four things. I would ask you all to read the forage fish policy and plan. And there's a 2007 report in there. Shows every spawning bed in the state. Okay? I would find out, what is senior staff's process to go through when somebody decides just not to follow the procedure anymore? Do you give permission? Do you ask to be informed? Or you don't know? Now, all eelgrass and herring are is the base of the food pyramid for everything on this chart and a lot of other things. Three, I would ask that we modify the staff's role as a patsy when somebody applies for a permit to do something that might cause this. Okay, the public is told, hey, we have to rely on our experts, and that's WDFW, and they don't have a problem. And that would include in follow-up, maybe we missed something. So we didn't think we needed precautions. Species disappears. I guess we ought to introduce some precautions. Don't see any prospect of doing that right now. And last but not least, when we take this approach, the Agriculture Department takes over management of our fish and wildlife. And if you want to know how it works, there it is. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hi.
So you mentioned that you do not believe that staff are implementing our salmon policy as written, so can you...
No, I mentioned I'm concerned that they might not, because they are very clearly not implementing the forage fish policy and plan. Okay. And so I suggest that you all look at what are the procedures and processes that, you know, where do you go to say, I'm not going to count herring anymore in Willapa Bay. I'm not going to count herring spawning anymore in Grays Harbor.
So that was your main
point? Yeah. And ask you to take a look at that. Is this just a big surprise, or does somebody say it's okay not to follow that policy anymore?
See.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to talk a little bit about the forage fish.
Yes.
Not necessarily related to Willapa Bay, but in general terms, in particular, my knowledge is in Puget Sound.
Yes.
And we used to have surveys of herring done at night by the state boats, and I don't know what year that ended. Maybe it was 07, as you stated. But the other thing that's happened, there's a significant reduction in forage fish in Puget Sound, particularly herring. And during that same time frame, we've had a very significant increase in pinnipeds, which feed on those same fish. So I would suggest to the director that we initiate some type of a plan to evaluate what we have and what we can do to increase forage fish stocks.
That's good. I talked to the biologist, and I said, have you not done anything since 2007? And he said, no, we've done quite a bit in Puget Sound. I said, how about Grays Harbor and Willapa Bay? Haven't done anything. So.
Well, I can't speak to that directly. I do know that I do some of the forage fish people that did surveys out of LeConnor and Anacortes for the department, and I think it was back in about 2007 that those ended.
It's the last published report.
Yep. I think it's important that we revisit that.
It's the base of our food pyramid. And they spawn on eelgrass.
They do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That'll bring...